Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Early in Barack Obama's campaign for president, a French journalist showed up on the scene to cover the campaign and became a real presence on the campaign trail. And I learned that Laura Heim was one of France's great broadcast journalists, having covered everything from war to American political campaigns. Most recently, she served as communications director for Emmanuel Macron in his extraordinary campaign for the presidency of France. And she's spent the fall quarter at the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago sharing her observations about that election, the state of democracy in France and the United States. Laura Heim, so glad to have you here, both on this podcast and at the Institute of Politics, where you've been a fellow all spring.
It was a fantastic experience. I can tell you that I did not know at all the university world. I did not know at all this special bubble in the American society. And it gave me hope, because there's a new generation here which is ready to do things and, in my opinion, which is really interested by different topics.
Yeah. No, this is why we do the work. And it is, you know, every time you get despairing about the world, you come here and you spend time with these young people and you think, you know, the future can be better.
Yeah, they challenge you and they understand what's happening and they're thinking in a global way and they still have hope and they're trying to understand different aspects of the American society and also the world. So it was an amazing experience. Yeah. And yes, I mean, you created, I know you're very shy sometimes, but I think you really created something quite unique here to pose and to think.
Well, it's certainly something really satisfying, because these kids are not wedded to the sort of orthodoxies of the past. They're skeptical, but they're not cynical. And as we said, they do give you hope. Let me talk about your life and career. I know you're just filibustering, so we don't get to the main topic here. But your folks were not... We're not journalists. Your father was a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Your mother was a music teacher.
Yeah, she did.
Tell me about them.
They were extraordinary. They were quite intellectual. My father was a doctor. He wanted me to become a doctor, and he did not understand why I wanted to be a journalist. And my mother had a passion. It was classical music. So I was raised with people, we were doing fellowship in my home to become a classical pianist. And
She was Israeli.
She was half French and half Israeli. And I was raised in a non-Jewish way. I mean, my parents were not religious. And we were living in France.
Did they have a history in
Europe? Yes, my family
suffered
tremendously from the Holocaust. My father's family had to escape in 1941, not to be killed. So there's a lot of stories in my family. And my mother also was living in France at this moment. She was young, so she had to hide in the countryside. And my father's family had to get false papers. They had to leave France, they went to Spain, they took a boat, and they went to Argentina for 6 years. Mm-hmm. And the family which didn't do that was killed in Auschwitz. So when they came back, they wanted to come back to France after living for 6 years in Argentina. When my father, who at the time was 13 years old, was raised, when they came back, they had to rebuild everything. And they believed in France after war, so they rebuilt everything. And they became quite successful. And then my father didn't want to be a CEO of the company of my grandfather. He wanted to be a doctor. He wanted to take care of the people. So
what kind of doctor was he? Just out of
he was a kind of, he was a very good generalist doctor. Mm-hmm. And then they created this kind of club in Paris with my mother about discussions, human rights, classical music. Again, when I went to bed, I always had someone in my house who was playing piano. And they really wanted to have a quite interesting life in Paris. And it was the golden years in Paris at this moment. It was the reconstruction. So I was born there, and I loved them very much.
You at an early age, you were pretending to be a radio broadcaster.
Yes.
So what is it that attracted you to journalism? Because you were being urged to follow different career paths.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I was, when you asked my family what happened to me, they still have this question, what happened to her? But why did she do that? I think I was watching TVs and I was very inspired by people who were covering historical events. So I was looking at people, for instance, I remember when I was 13, there was the war in the Malouines in Argentina. There were a lot of things happening in Central America, revolution. And I was very inspired by that. And there was also a lot of things in the Middle East. And I really wanted to be like them. I watched them and I said, wow, they're covering the world. They're explaining to us what's happening. I want to be like them. So I decided to do political school, and it was not for me. And I decided that, okay, I want to be on the field. So instead of going to school for a lot of years, why am I not trying right away to be in a radio? And I convinced someone to hire me in a radio. I was 17 years old.
So you came from this highly educated family. That probably didn't sit well with
drama.
Them that you were going to...
Drama. My mother was, what's happening? And my father was, are you sure you want to do that? And then he paused and he said, you just have to be happy. So if you're happy, I'm going to support you.
That's a good parent.
I think it was perfect. Right. He understood me very well.
Yeah, and he obviously understood that this was a passion of yours.
Mm-hmm.
And you fell, and you talked your way into a job, as you were saying.
So my first job was to bring coffees. I did that for 6 months. I was bringing coffees to people all the time. Uh-huh. I was in a radio, and I was an intern. They didn't know what to do with me. I really had an interview with someone, and I said, give me an internship for 6 months. And I convinced this person, and I brought coffees for 6 months, and I make the point to be the first one to arrive and the last one to leave.
This is such an important lesson, you know. I mean, I think about my own life, and I wanted to be a journalist. I went back after my first year of college to New York City, and I had no real background at all, and I knocked on maybe 75 doors until I found a little newspaper, the Villager newspaper in Greenwich Village, that was sort of down on its luck. And they figured if they could hire me, they paid me $50 a week to do everything. Mm-hmm. And I was willing to do everything, that it was a good deal. And I spent 6 months there, and it was foundational. I mean, I learned so much doing it.
I learned a lot. And then I wanted a job. And I wanted to be a reporter. So I found out that...
After 6 months of delivering coffee.
Yes. And then I went to see the news director, and he said the only job you can have is to work on the radio from 5 o'clock in the evening until 3 o'clock in the morning. You have to remember I was 18. I wanted to go to party. So to work 5 days a week when you're 18 from 5 o'clock in the evening to 3 o'clock in the morning, it's no life. And I said, yeah, I'm going to do that. So I did that.
There must have been stuff going on at after three.
I can tell you that I still know all the places in Paris open after 3 o'clock.
I know this story because I was a nightside reporter myself.
Yeah. So it was really a good year. The best years, I was with a group of people. We see each other since then. We really worked hard and we were preparing what you're going to say. It's here, the morning show. So we were doing that. And then.
You had some great mentors back then as well.
Yeah, I think I worked hard and I was very competitive and I was pushing the doors. There was someone who told me when you put the foot in the door, it's really difficult after to close it.
Yes.
And I was a little bit known for that with sometimes critics. I was a woman, so I pushed also for me as a woman in the newsroom. And it was absolutely fascinating, and I was really part of this machine. Then I noticed that you have a lot of French holidays, you know, in France, and journalists in France, they're taking holidays. They don't stop. So in the summer, it's holidays, and the newsroom are empty. And when the newsroom are empty, when there's a big story happening, they're taking the interns or the young people. So I didn't go on holidays. I stayed in Paris and I did my first exclusive in the middle of August. There was a very famous TV personality who was missing. He went to Africa and people for 3 days were looking for him. And they thought it was a kind of promotion for himself to make think he was missing. And in fact, he has been kidnapped and he was killed in Africa. And it was a big story. And I was right there. So then, slowly but surely, I made my way up and I stayed in...
How old were you when you did that story?
I was 19. Mm-hmm. And then someone was listening to me all the time during August, and he was the new owner. And he lived in the United States. He was fascinated by the United States. He's a very famous French journalist. His name is Philippe Labro. He's a writer. And he wanted to help young people. So when he was listening to me, he said, how old is this woman? And someone told him she's 19. So he said, I want to see her. So I had a meeting with him and he said, what do you want to do? And he asked me if I wanted to cover the nightlife in Paris, if I wanted to go to movies, theaters, and to do that and to have my own small program. And I said, yes. And after...
Still on the radio?
Still on the radio, prime time. I was terrible at it. I mean, it was the worst time of my life. But I mean, I was...
Because you weren't interested in the subject?
Yeah, I wasn't. I mean, it was... it was interesting because I had fun in a way. But it was really like, you know, go to the Cannes Festival, go to a lot of Hollywood things. And it was not for
Sounds
me.
Sounds like hard duty.
Yeah, but that was the trick. I mean, people were, oh my God, you paid to go to see movies and to go to theaters. And then there was a kind of wake-up call. And it was a very important thing in my mind. I was at the Cannes Film Festival, and one of my friends, I began with this friend, was in China, and he was covering Tiananmen.
Yeah.
And I was, what am I doing here in Cannes? I don't want to be in Cannes. I want to go to Tiananmen, and I want to cover what's happening in China. I was really about that. And I went to see my boss, and I told him, this is it for me, I'm quitting. I don't want to do that because I didn't choose journalism to do that. And he was, what? You become famous here? What's happening? I said, no, I really want to do something about the world we live in. And at this time, there was a group of people who created a small video journalist agency, which was called Kappa. Mm-hmm. And the idea was very simple. No correspondent in front of the camera. You act as a photojournalist, but with a small camera. And I have to remember that it was in 1989.
Yeah.
So it was quite a revolution. And you're not going to make a lot of money, but you're going to cover the world and be with interesting people. And I was, the inspiration was Robert Kappa, the photographer who, you know, was the famous war photographer. And we decided to do that with a small channel at this time. The name of the small channel was Canal+. And we created a weekly news magazine, which was called 24 Hours. And for 24 hours, with five different video journalists, you're showing a world event. And it became extremely successful because we were able to do a lot of cinema vérité way. The characters in front of the cameras were the people were following. And basically, it was a tribe, and it really became very, very important in my life. So from
and you it took you to some pretty tough and dangerous places.
Yeah, I didn't speak about danger. I was always interested to be where it's happening. And I always say to people who ask me this question, I don't like thing about, oh, you have been a war correspondent. I don't think at all like that. I really think that when you're going to dangerous situation, you just want to witness what's happening. And
The famine in Somalia.
Yeah, I did Somalia.
Bosnia.
Yes, the beginning of the
Gaza.
War in Bosnia. Yes, Gaza. Very interesting for me because I was Jewish, so I went to the other side, and it was very.
And what did you learn there?
I learned that I met ordinary people doing extraordinary things, and that was what I wanted to show. And I learned that, when people want freedom, want independence, want to do something, at one point, life does not matter anymore. There's an idea which is better than them. And that's what I wanted to document.
You know, I'm interested if I could just stop there for a second about being being Jewish and covering that side of the conflict and whether you felt conflicted yourself in any way.
I felt that I didn't know Israel and that I didn't want at this time to know Israel. I was working in Palestine with the Palestinian people, and I really understood a lot of things that I didn't understand when I was in Paris. And then years after, because I went a lot to Gaza, I went a lot to Ramallah, I went a lot to Bethlehem, years after I said, I have to stop, because now the conflict is there. I'm Jewish, and what's happening when I'm covering the Palestinians' cause, especially when the Palestinian cause, especially in 2003, became really radicalized with a lot of suicide bombing. That was more and more difficult. And I became very depressed. I mean, when you're in the Middle East, when you're covering what's happening, after a certain point, the story is getting on you, and you're really going down if you're not careful. I still have mixed feeling about covering the Middle East.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with Laura Heim. You also had an interview with Fidel Castro. How did you get that interview?
Oh, it was a kind of thing. I sit down in a hotel. It was during the Olympic Games. He was in Barcelona at this time, and I heard that he was coming. So I went to the hotel, and I sit down for one day, and I wait for him to get out. When he get out, I stopped him, and I was speaking a little bit of Spanish, and he stopped in front of me, and he said, "Buenos dias, ¿cómo está?" And then I began to speak, and it was not a sit-down interview, but it was a kind of encounter. But that's also the things that I used to do, because I was with Kappa, and we had someone who was pushing us to be on the road all the time, to try things which were never done before, to be idealist, and to really push to get closer to the real events. So we did that, and Castro was part of this time. Yes.
I'm gonna interrupt this to go back. I feel like I'm thinking in my head, I need to pursue one thing, and then we'll pick it up with...
Okay.
You say that the Middle East became more difficult to cover, presumably not just because of the threats associated with it.
No, you don't think about the threat.
But why did it become more difficult?
Because you always have to choose side. And there are good and bad people on both sides. And that's where the conflict happened for me, you know, which side am I choosing? And I don't want to choose a side. As a journalist, I want to be neutral. I want to see what's happening. So that was difficult. And maybe we're going to speak a little bit of that, but I was in Baghdad also.
Yes.
And it has deep effect on me. So I wanted to do a pause from my Middle East experience. And then I'm always saying it's addicting because when my father died, 2 days, and I had a very, I'm still moved about that, but I had to go back to the Middle East 2 days after.
When was that?
It was in July 2014. And 2 days after, the war in Gaza began. And I said to my editor at the time, okay, let me go back to the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. What conclusions have you drawn from that, all of that reporting there about the prospects for resolving this?
I think it needs strong people and strong people with sensitivities and sensibilities.
And on both sides?
From both sides.
Do you see them now?
No, I don't. I see a radicalization from both sides. And I will always encourage people who are working in the Middle East to live the ordinary life on both sides. I did a documentary about a Palestinian family and an Israeli family, and I was working at the time as a video journalist producer for 60 Minutes too. And I remember this story vividly. There were two women. One woman, her name was Rachel. She was 20 years old. And the other woman, her name was Ayat. She was also 20 years old. They really look similar. Rachel was living in Israel. Ayat was living in Palestine. And then one day, Ayat decided to blow herself up in a supermarket and she killed Rachel. And I documented the families from both sides. And I followed them year after year after year. I went to see the mothers. I went to see the brothers. I wanted to understand those two women who looked like sisters. I think Newsweek did a cover on them. What happened to them? And how, at one point, I think they have been in school together. And suddenly, boom, one is killing the other. They didn't know each other, even if when they were a child, they had been in school. What happened to them? And what was very interesting for me year after year is to see slowly but surely the radicalization of the two mothers. I wanted the two mothers, I think 5 years after, to meet. It was impossible. Mm. And I told them, but you lost a daughter. You have to meet. That's how peace is going to begin. And they never wanted to meet.
Listening to you reminds me, in 1994, I was with a group of Americans who went to Israel, and we met with Yitzhak Rabin shortly before he was killed. And this was in the midst of the Oslo peace process. And someone in the group said, what will you tell the settlers who will have to move if you strike this deal? And he said, I remember very wearily, he said, I'd say that too many of our children have lost their lives. Too much blood has been spent, and peace has a price, and this is a price. And it speaks to what you were saying. He was a leader, and you could sense it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've said this before, but I think when you consider the last 100 years of history, there probably wasn't a more destructive act than the young Israeli who shot Rabin, because I think that...
That was the beginning of the big shift in Israel.
Yes.
And it still is,
yes.
With also the religion aspect happening at this moment.
You moved to the U.S.
So in 1992, I was in Kappa, and I fell in love with New York. I went on holidays in New York. I was walking in the street in New York, and I said, that's it. I have to live there. So I came back to Paris and I said that to my family. Was what? You're going to move back?
By this time, they're probably used to your baffling decision making.
Yeah, I had a big crisis with my mother about Sarajevo, because when I came back from Sarajevo, my mother was in tears telling me I didn't do a daughter to go to Sarajevo. And it was very difficult. But
because she was worried about it.
She was extremely worried. And you have also to think about people who are so much worried about you when you're doing this type of work. But anyway, so I moved to New York. I decided to convince Canal Plus, which was at the time, and Canal Plus for the American audience was became very, very successful after in the United States. They were part of Vivendi Universal. They produced a lot of movies. But at the time, it was like the beginning of HBO. And I decided to convince my boss to create a first office in the United States in New York. And he looked at me, he said, okay, for 3 months. So it's my theory. I had a foot in the door. So right. I went for 3 months and then I stayed 12 years.
Yeah.
And I developed Canal Plus. I always, during my holidays, I didn't take any French holidays. I was really living the New York way. And I always made the point to do 2 documentaries about important issues when I was in New York. So I did a lot of documentaries for Kappa and I was also in New York. And then
documentaries elsewhere. So
completely. Yeah. I did a documentary about Calcutta, a woman who are trying to fight AIDS and who created a program to educate poor women in Calcutta. I did something about crimes in America with a very famous photojournalist. And we were doing a lot of things about chain gangs in Alabama. I really wanted... Still, because you can be in a bubble when you're in a corporation. And I really wanted to make sure that I was not staying in this bubble and that I was going to be able to see always see the real world. So I did that. And then in 2001... 9/11 happened.
And that was right. You were living nearby.
Yeah, I have a very... I wrote a book about yes. that. So I'm going to try to be quick telling you the story. I was doing a story about gang violence in Miami. And then I was supposed to fly back on the 10th of September. And I decided to fly back on 9/11 in the morning. My apartment was 3 blocks away from the World Trade Center. So I was in a plane on 9/11,
and grounded,
landing
huh?
in New York. It was 8:30 because I took my plane at 6 o'clock in the morning. And it has a huge impact on me because my I know people who were there. My neighborhood was destroyed. I really saw something, of course, like all of us Americans, that I never saw before. And I became very American there.
Yeah, no, it's interesting you say all of us Americans. That was the moment when you decided to become an American
citizen. Yeah, it was in
citizen.
My mind, but I really wanted at this time to shift big uh-huh. time. And I decided
what
to...
But explain that decision to me more, will you?
The unity of the United States at this particular moment, which mm-hmm. I found extremely moving. And I became very patriotic about the best values in America and the endless possibilities. But I saw... In New York, during 9/11, the best of people. I was very moved by that.
You know, it's interesting because we are very divided now as a country.
Yes.
And I mean, there's no disputing that. And yet when things happen, whether it's a hurricane or some other event, you see people rallying to each other's side.
Yeah, that's what I'm calling
I'm trying to reconcile the fact that When things happened, Houston was a good example of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people rallied. They weren't checking each other's voter registration card. They weren't asking themselves. They weren't asking quizzes about politics. They were leaping in, trying to help each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it was inspiring. And then we retreat back into our silos and paint portraits of each other that... are often dehumanizing. It's baffling. The other thing that happened as a result of 9/11 is a war. And you mentioned earlier that you went to Baghdad. You spent 4 years there.
Yeah, I was. So 9/11 happened. I became more and more a video journalist, like a photojournalist. I documented the downfall of Enron, which also had an impact on me because I saw how you can be laid off in America in less than 1 hour when a corporation is going down. And then I decided to do this type of work with my small camera. And then I went back to Israel for French TV. And the bus exploded in front of me. And I had a camera with me. Dan Rather was across the street and he was taking a coffee. He didn't have a camera. And he came to me, said, "You have a camera, can you film for me?" Mm-hmm. And I filmed in the way that I knew how to film for French TV, this kind of cinema verite way. So Dan Rather was moving around the situation. They really liked my things. It made the opening.
This would became a kind of partnership.
Yeah. And then Rather told me, "You have to come to New York." I said, "I live in New York." He said, "What? With your French accent, you live in New York?" He said, "I want you to work with me and do breaking news with me." So
Did you say him with your Texas accent?
Yeah, exactly. I said "we" with my Texas accent. So 3 weeks after, that's also the beauty of America. People recognize sometimes that they need you and it goes quickly. So I went to New York. I was hired by Rather. I had a freelance contract for CBS and it was...
But you still were doing your work for...
Canal Plus. Yeah, mm-hmm. And I took a sabbatical from Canal Plus and it was time for me to do something else. I really felt it. And it's my sixth sense which is telling me that. I always feel that that was time. I need to be with new people to learn something. I always want to learn new things. And I mean, Dan Rather, that was a big person in the and he still is in the journalistic world, you know. And CBS News at the time was a big name. And I said, okay, I really want to try to do that. So I also had a French passport. And the Middle East was going to explode. And the fact that I had a French passport was, in my opinion, a big plus for them because I was able to go to see, again, what I'm calling the other side. So they hired me and they asked me if I wanted to go to the Middle East. I went back to Gaza at the beginning of the war and then really nothing happened. I desperately wanted to go to Iraq. So I based myself in Jordan for 2 months. And I can tell you that it was really hard for me to get a visa. I sit down in the Jordan embassy for 2 days and two nights waiting for the visa.
So they finally wanted, they were so desperate to get rid of you.
Yeah,
they gave it to
and
you.
I mean, at the end, I wish I could have his name. The guy came and he said, "You know, we're closing the Iraqi embassy in Jordan. You're the last one and I see you in the past 2 days and two nights. Okay, I'm going to give you your visa." So I got the visa and I went to Baghdad. I worked for CBS there and my assignment was as a producer to help them, as a video journalist to document what was happening to the life of the Iraqi people.
But you stayed for a...
Yeah, so we were doing rotations, 6 weeks, 3 weeks, 6 weeks in Baghdad, 3 weeks back in the United States or wherever you wanted to. And it was an extraordinary team. It was a collective group. And there was Dan Rather, there was another woman called Kimberly Doge, Elizabeth Palmer, there were extraordinary executive producers, Peter Bluff, Jim Murphy. I mean, there were good people, and we really wanted to show something. So I did that.
You, I spent some time, as you know, recently with your friend Christiane Amanpour.
Yes, I met Christiane.
And we talked about that, about Iraq and what went wrong. And she said that it was the war went fine. It was the aftermath and the complete sort of misplaying of the situation after the war that led to where we are.
Yeah, today. I cannot agree more. It was really the aftermath because when the Americans arrived in Baghdad, the Iraqis, and I was with the Iraqis at this time, they didn't know what to expect. And they were, okay, maybe it's going to work. Saddam was not good for us, and let's see what's happening. And I'm always like to tell, again, stories about ordinary people. And there's a story which happened in Fallujah that I witnessed. In the July 2003, in Fallujah, there were the American troops were there, and the Iraqis wanted to talk to them. And they were doing a big lunch, you know, the Arabic lunch. And I remember that the tribal leaders, it took them 1 week to prepare what they called the meshui. And they wanted the Americans to have a good meshui. And when the American troops arrived, someone, it was probably in the first minute of the discussion, he said, "Can I have a Coca-Cola?" And the level of trust was over from before the discussion began. I mean, it's everything was wrong with this sentence. It was something that you don't do in the Middle East, you know, the importance of having a coffee, the importance of sitting down. So I witnessed a lot of things happening like that. There were more and more troops acting this way. They didn't know what to do. There were also political decisions which were made by Paul Brenner at this time. And it was completely over in less than 6 months. So the aftermath was not thought.
Yeah.
Definitely.
That's the what I learned in my brief experience in government was the question that isn't often asked, and the one that is most important is what's next, you know?
Exactly.
And it wasn't asked there. I came to know you in 2008.
Yeah, so...
On the Obama campaign.
I remember the sweater you had in Iowa. I mean, it's one
it was confiscated by the Board of Health.
You had a horrible sweater. I remember you were in behind the scene in Des Moines, and I saw you. So I came back to New York in 2006. I didn't want to do wars anymore. I was really tired. I wanted a pause, and I said, maybe I'm going to work on a political campaign. So everybody in France, I went back to France because Dan Rather was fired in 2006 and I was part of the package. So I went back to the French and they asked me, do you want to follow Hillary Clinton? And they said, I'm interested by following someone who is an outsider. And they said, who? And I said, Barack Obama. And I remember on the phone, my editor telling me, who? Barack who?
Yes.
And I said...
We got a lot of that back then.
Yeah. And I said Barack Obama because I was following the Democratic Convention in 2004 and I thought his speech was quite eloquent. And I don't know, I wanted to do someone else than follow someone else than Hillary Clinton. So I went to Harlem, I remember. It was in October 2007. And I wanted to see Barack Obama in Harlem. And there were thousands of people outside who wanted to come. And there was an energy, there was something. And I said, I want to see what's happening with this person. So I jumped there. I went to Iowa. You met me there.
Yes.
I think you told me, oh, if the French are there, maybe we have a chance. And then I was part of the beginning of an extraordinary campaign. And I
You were with us in Europe.
I was
when we
with
went
you
in the summer
in
of 2008. So you were there when we were in France, and you must have been there when we went to Germany. And,
no, I was not in Germany
that was quite
with
a scene.
You. I know, the Berlin Wall. Yeah.
So what was your impression when of how the Europeans were reacting to him?
Oh, my God. It was, they were fascinated by him, and they really wanted to follow him. They wanted him to be the American president.
Why?
Because he was the symbol of hope. And a new face. And the fact that he was African-American was also a big thing for the French. Look what's happening in America. It's possible for someone like him to become president of the United States. And then he's doing an amazing campaign based on hope, often change. He was very inspirational, and he still is. There was recently a poll in France that if Obama wants to be president of France, people are voting for him at 80%. So, I mean, he's extremely popular in France. And it was not only the campaign, it was the energy, it was the civil society that you saw day after day in the reports. And a country which is switching, and a country which is pushing for someone new. That was really important. And it still is. I mean, people have vivid memories on the 2007 campaign and the 2008 election.
Explain what America... I think Americans don't perceive necessarily completely what the role of our country is in the rest of the world.
I will say that the rest of the world is speaking about America when America doesn't speak at all about the rest of the world. So when there's a presidential campaign happening in France, people are following that closely. Each night, each morning in the news, you have at least one or two reports about the contenders. People at this time knew John McCain, they knew Barack Obama, they knew you. I mean, they're really interested by American politics because they think that America is still a big country in the world and that they have to pay attention to what's happening in this democracy.
What's the mood now?
Depressed, worried. What's happening? Are you still the first power in the world? What's going to happen with Donald Trump? If you go to France and if you have a discussion with French people, they're going to ask you two questions. They're going to ask you, what's happening with Trump? Is he crazy? Is he going to be impeached? And then when you speak about Obama, they're going also to ask you a question about President Obama, which is what happened in Syria.
In Syria?
Yes.
And his decisions
yes,
there?
Yes, absolutely. This is a big question for the French people. What happened with him and his decision regarding Syria? Because then it has a direct effect.
Because of the migration.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've covered several terrorist attacks in France.
I was living in the U.S. But
you went back... Jewish school was attacked in Toulouse?
No, I was in the U.S., but I followed that very closely because I was always and I'm still interested by the radicalization. I mean, I think our daily life has forever changed.
You also commented from the U.S.
on the
Charlie Hebdo.
Yeah, Charlie Hebdo and on the Bataclan. Yes, because my friends were there. You know, I worked with a lot of young people and my brother lived in this neighborhood and the Bataclan was... I don't like to do the comparison, but it was the 9/11 of France. And it was a very tragic event. And, you know, for instance, it happened on November 13th. It was 2 years ago. And a few days ago, President Macron went on the site and all the French people were extremely moved. And me, I was extremely moved, but nobody was talking about that in the United States, that the Bataclan attacks happened 2 years ago.
And these attacks have, France has felt a heavy blow of that. Obviously, the British have, but these attacks are happening around Europe. What impact has this had on the politics of Europe?
It has a huge impact because it's in our daily life. There's now each week, unfortunately, an attack. When you speak to the French people about that, they're not telling you, oh my God, it's over, we had the Bataclan. Everybody is prepared for when it's going to happen again, what's next. And we learn to live with that. And it has a big impact also on the debates inside the French political life because you can play a lot with terrorism, you can play a lot with the fear of people, and this is quite dangerous. And politicians, in my opinion, have to be extremely careful when they're exploiting the fear factor.
We're going to take another break, and we'll be right back with Laura Heim. You talk about the fear factor. We've seen, and you've studied, and in here during your visit at the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago, you've been talking about the state of democracy in Europe. And you know, there are concerns on both sides of the ocean here. But you look at someone like Angela Merkel.
Yes.
Who is has been at the center of European politics for a decade, more than a decade now, unable to form a government because the right wing has...
Exactly. And that's unfortunately, I have to say, a failure. I mean, people are afraid. And when they're afraid, they go to the people who are saying what they want to hear. They're going to what people, the populists know they know really well how to do that. The exploitation of the fear factor, the exploitation of, look, he's coming to your country. He's going to be bad. He's going to do bad things. He's going to blow himself up. He's going to take your job. And when you're looking at this moment in Europe, at the populist movement, not only in Germany with the far right, but also, for instance, in Poland. Last week in Poland, there was a demonstration with more than 60,000 people for the white Poland. You know, it's happening all over. And this is very, very scary because Europe has to be extremely strong together, united, to fight that. And I always come back to the notion of education and to the notion of what is our responsibility when we're explaining something to people. Can we explain in a better way what's happening in the world? What are the important problems? And can we really do this type of deep work?
You made a decision. You've spent your life in journalism.
Yes.
And you made a decision to take a little detour into politics and work for a candidate who is considered kind of certainly an outsider, maybe a long shot when he began. But talk about your association with Emmanuel Macron.
I followed Barack Obama. I'm going to be quite precise with you because I'm not sure even yourself you know the full story. So
that's why I'm here.
Yeah, exactly. So I followed Barack Obama for 8 years in Washington. And then the last year, I wanted to know who was going to be the next president of the United States. And I went to Iowa, and I went to South Carolina, and I went to Florida, and I spent a lot of time in the bars, in the restaurants. I was documenting that for my channel, and I spoke with people. And there was always a name coming back, Trump. And I was, what? And I did not know really well Trump, you know. I was covering Barack Obama. I watched TV. I saw this guy saying, you're fired. I saw him as a TV personality. And then I really began to be interested by him. I followed his activities in New York as a businessman. And in April 2015, on French TV, I was questioned. And I said, Donald Trump might become president of the United States. And I had a lot of fights with very powerful people.
I wish you'd given me a call. You could have saved me a lot of trouble there.
But. No, but I can tell you the story that I never said before, but in the summer of 2015, I was invited in the Hamptons. And someone, a very famous person, I can give his name, the founder of Doctors Without Borders, Bernard Kouchner, asked me, who do you think is going to be president? I said, Trump has a big chance. And we had a terrible fight. Like screaming, he was screaming at me, you're crazy, you live too long here. And then I had a fight with my editors because I wanted a budget to cover Trump. I wanted to do a book about Trump, and the publisher declined, saying, you're crazy, you have been for too long in America. I remember the quote. And then finally, the Canal Plus people said, okay, we're going to give her a budget. And I covered Trump for 1 year. I felt that he was coming to the United States, to the political life. Because I'm not talking about his ideas. I'm talking about the way he was doing a campaign. He understood something inside the American society that very few people understood. And it's the desire of the middle class. And he was exploiting that in a very clever way. And I think people are saying, especially in France, he's stupid. He doesn't know what he does. This guy. And I always said, he's not stupid. He knows exactly how to do a good campaign. So I was quite known for that. So
Let me just stop you for a second and say, how much do you recognize in some of these populist, nationalist movements around Europe, how much do you see intimations of what Trump has done and continues to do here?
I think Marine Le Pen, when she was running a campaign, it's very much inspired by
Marine
Le Pen
in France,
the leader of the National Front. She was extremely inspired by Trump. She wanted to be Trump woman. She did a campaign like Trump did, but I mean, France is not the United States. So the populist message, it's very simple. It's a formula, you know. You go on stage, you have a lot of personalities, you're saying, I'm not a traditional politician. You're playing a lot with the cameras and with the crowd. You make sure that in each event, something unusual happened. You're doing a kind of political meeting like you're doing a kind of game. You don't develop precise ideas. You have two or three good formulas. You make people loath. And then that's it.
So we were getting up to Macron and your decision.
So
to work
then,
in that campaign.
My channel at the end of the Donald Trump campaign, my channel was, my news division was completely destroyed because a new CEO came and said, we want to do entertainment. We do not want to do serious news anymore. And it is an important element because we fought. We went on strike. You know, the French people love to strike. And we decided to go to the streets and to have words saying, we're going to die, but we're going to die by defending serious journalism. And I was doing the Trump campaign at the time. I was deeply affected by that. At the end of the Trump campaign, I had to film with my cell phone the Trump events. I was with my coworkers defending serious journalism. So after the presidential campaign, after 8 years in Washington, I wanted a pause. I came back to Paris. I wanted really a pause because, of course, against the big corporation which wanted to do ratings on entertainment, we lost. So the news division was completely killed. And I said, that's it. I really have to think about what's happening. I went to Paris, you know, in the beginning of December, and I watched on my bed Macron on TV. It was a meeting which is called the Porte de Versailles meeting, because suddenly Macron is on stage and he's screaming, but really screaming, I'm going to change things. I'm going to be president. I'm going to do things. And he had passion. And I said, this guy, he's going to be president. I picked up the phone and I called his team and I said, listen, they told me, you want an interview? I said, no, I don't want an interview. You know what happened in my news channel. I just want to see how I can help you. I have some experience in America. Do you think I can have an appointment with him just to speak about what he wants to do? And then I had my appointment 2 days after and we spoke for 35 minutes. It was last year. And I met him in his office. His wife was there. And I told him, listen, I think you're going to become president. And he said, what? I said, I really think you have a chance to become president of France because you're coming at the right moment. And I also saw a light in his eyes. And you probably saw that. But they're always the politicians, the people who want to do that. They have what I'm calling a special gene.
If they're successful.
Yeah, but even in the fight, they want to do it. And sometimes you can see that people want to do it for something else than their own egos. They really want to transform a society.
And did you sense that from him?
Absolutely. Right away. I felt it.
Because he seems like a terribly ambitious person.
Yeah, but ambitious, in my opinion, is part of, you know, when you want to become president, you have to be ambitious.
Of course, yeah.
And I saw that he was young, he had a lot of energy. I was also interested a lot by his wife. It was, I mean, you know, there's
been a lot of interest in
her
because they're unusual.
Well, I mean, in December, it's the first time I saw them together. I thought it was a very strong couple, and I still think it's a very strong couple. And then he asked me if I wanted to become part of the team and to join the adventure. And I said, I just have to move from Washington. And he said, when can you come? I would like you to be there as soon as possible. So 2 weeks after, I was in Paris.
So what was that journey like?
Very interesting, because I was crossing the line and I went to the other side. So
was that hard for you?
Very hard. Yeah. And I mean, it was extremely hard.
I made that switch, but much earlier in my career.
It was really hard. It was not hard with the candidate. It was hard with the people around, because the people around are real politicians. And you're coming from the civil society, and you're bringing something from the civil society. But
they
you
don't
have,
I want to hear it.
I mean, yeah, you have interesting discussions.
What about with your former colleagues in the media?
Oh my God, I became the story of the week and even the month. And there were jokes on French radio saying we speak much more about her than we speak about Macron. But so it was good for Macron because, I mean, the thing which was good for Macron was the ability to show that he was able to capture people from the civil society. There was me, there was a very, very strong economic advisor. His name is Jean Pisani-Ferry, was very reliable, very serious, and he came at the right time. And each day in January, Macron announced someone coming from the civil society joining En Marche. And you have to remember, it's not America, it's France, traditional parties.
Yes, he created his own movement.
So he created his movement, and he was able to show, okay, at En Marche, we're able to have people from the civil society joining us.
What I was wondering about though was, was there any cynicism on the part of your colleagues that you had somehow sold out, or that you traded in your objectivity?
No, it was not cynicism. It was, why did you do that? I mean, that was the question. You're a serious journalist. You have been through a lot. You're respected. Why do you cross the line? Because it's not like in America. When you cross the line in France, you're crossing the line. And I said, because maybe I have been disappointed by the kind of journalism I wanted to do. And that was my motivation. I mean, what do I want to do as a journalist? Do I want to do serious issues, or do I want to do 2 minutes clip mm-hmm. about an Hollywood star? And I think it was the time for me to switch, to do something still serious about, you know, a society, and to see the other side. I thought, and I'm very American on that, because I have this debate in France, and I'm always saying, I think in one life, you can have multiple lives. And I defend this idea.
But you didn't accept a position in the government. You could have.
Yeah.
And you decided not to. So having made the switch, when it came to governing, you didn't want to do it.
Because I think that you have two times, you have the campaign and you have the government aspect. And I was not sure, and I had this discussion with the president, I was not sure that I was going to be able to function inside the government. Mm-hmm. And
journalists by nature are iconoclasts. They're challenging authority, challenging institutions. It's
yes.
a tough adjustment to move inside of government.
Yeah, and I always want to be critical, and I also wanted to make sure that I was going to be accepted by the team. And I think at one point I did a campaign, and for me it was time to go back to
the
U.S.
There also was the issue of your dual citizenship.
I have an American passport, so when you have an American passport and when you have a French passport, I think one day you have to choose which country you prefer.
And you did.
I came back to Chicago.
Yes, and we're happy to have you. Talk for a couple of minutes about Macron, where he is now. And he seems to have ambitions to be a force for the reconciliation of Europe. He's clearly trying to reform some of the institutions of France. And these are major lifts. How do you think he's doing?
I think he's going very quickly. And that's part of his strength, in my opinion, and his ambition. He definitely wants to reform France in a unusual aspect. And I'm saying that Macron is now the new CEO of France. He really wants to change everything. He's trying. He did a lot of things in less than 6 months. People, when he was elected, said in France, everybody is going to be in the street. The unions are going to demonstrate. It's going to be a new French revolution in the fall. It didn't didn't happen. So he already did a lot of changes he did a law to moralize the political life. He did some executive orders about how the working system is operating in France when you're a company, how you can be more flexible, how you can fire more people, how you can hire more people. So he's doing a lot of things which have never been done before. He has a very good image all over the world. He's trying to be a key player on the international scene. So that's the positive thing.
So I saw internally his approval rating is around 40, in the low 40s.
Yeah, but I will say that it's a difficult country to change. And due to the fact now I'm outside and I have my freedom of speech, I will say that you have to be careful about two fronts. Because you have a front which is ready to move on, which understands the globalization, which really want to create companies, and which is extraordinary. And then
that's his base.
That's his base, and other people also. And you have another front which is, you know, attached to other things. It doesn't mean good or bad. But for instance, when you are 55 years old, you maybe do not have the energy to create another company and to go back to the beginning or to move to another city. And this second France, he has to be careful with them. That's my feeling.
That's, of course, there's another parallel there with the United States, because that is the core of the Trump constituency. When you say make America great again, that really resonates with these 55-year-olds who aren't going to or don't want to retrain and move. And
yeah, so Macron was aware during the campaign, he was talking about that. And he said, we're going to do formation. So if you're losing your job at 40 or 45 years old, there will be a special program which will be put in, which will be in place to teach you another job. But it's also in the mentalities, you know. You have to make sure that you're not just doing a country for the startuppers.
Yes.
And on the other way, a lot of people want France to change. So, you know, we're very complex. We love to debate. We love to go to the street when there's something happening. The French people love to have long intellectual discussions. For instance, during the campaign in France, I was mesmerized when I arrived to see how a French campaign is happening compared to an American campaign. Because you cannot do a stump speech. You know, in America, the candidates are doing 22-minute speech. Macron, his speech was for 2 hours, 30 minutes. Yeah. And sometimes we had to tell him, it's too long. You cannot do that. And he said, I need to do those type of speeches because the French people love substance. And it's true. The French, they love substance. They take politics very seriously. And they like when someone is explaining to them for 2 hours what he wants to do.
2.5 hours could be substance abuse. I don't know.
No. It was very good. I mean, when you speak about important issues, you know, it's like what's happening in the TV world. I mean, we had different laws in France. We have the principle of equality, like the last 2 weeks of the French presidential campaign. Each candidate, by law, has the same amount of time on TV and on radio, which, as you know, didn't happen in the United States. But the French people and the French system are taking very seriously their responsibilities about democracy.
Last thing, because I'd be remiss if I didn't ask. Everybody here was sort of fascinated by the world's, you talk about long speeches, we also saw the world's longest handshake between Macron and Trump.
I was not in the room when it happened, but I can tell you, knowing Emmanuel Macron, that it was not at all prepared. I think it was like a moment in which Donald Trump took his hand. There were a lot of photographers. And don't forget, Emmanuel Macron is 39 years old. He's young. So sometimes, you know, yes, he's doing a handshake and he doesn't know how, in which direction it's going to go. And then the press is speaking about the handshake. But I really think that in a more serious way, for Emmanuel Macron, from the beginning, the relation between the United States and France is extremely important.
So he's going to try and work with Trump. They have
Absolutely.
Probably a better relationship from a distance than Trump has with a lot of other traditional American allies.
I was witnessing the first phone call between Donald Trump and Emmanuel Macron, And I can tell you that on serious issues, they're definitely going to work together. I mean, there's a big disagreement about the Paris Agreement.
On climate change.
On climate change. But on the fight against terrorism, yes, it's important. And I really think you have to understand that about President Macron. You know, he's young. He wants to do something. He wants to build up a new France. He wants to build up a new Europe. And I hope he's going to succeed.
Lorheim, it's been such a pleasure to have you here this quarter at the University of Chicago. And you're a person who's had great impact with your journalism. You've had great impact in your brief political career, and I look forward to seeing what you're going to do now.
Thank you, David. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.